Hey, welcome back to Endpoint TV. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs. Today, joined by Josh Honeyman from the Dynamics AX team. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so I know a lot of people are like, Dynamics, what's like Dynamics AX? What is that?
Well, Dynamics AX is one of our ERP solutions that we deliver at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. You know, for the novice, it's kind of like accounting software on steroids.
Yeah.
Everything from supply chain management to accounts receivable to accounts payable. All that kind of stuff is involved in an ERP solution. So we're talking about very complex business processes that are basically automated within the software.
Ah, okay. Now, many years ago, gosh, this would be like 10, 12, 13 years ago, you know, I worked for an ERP company. I was actually working on their CRM product, but mm-hmm. This was in the late 90s, you know. So back in that time, the model was, I'm going to produce some massive enterprise software. It's a 2 to 3 year implementation process. We're going to bring in a ton of consultants, and they're going to write all this custom code to tailor the thing for your business, and huge risky projects. Just, it was like a, you know, huge deal, right?
Yeah.
And so I was actually a dev lead for that company, and we figured that we were writing, you know, 75% of the solution with big, like, insert your code here pieces, because every business is different, right?
Yep.
And so, but the world doesn't work that way anymore. People are sick of that model.
Oh, they are very much sick of that model. I mean, I think if you look at, like, how much these companies spend on adapting their software to meet their business needs, you'd be very, very surprised.
Yeah.
From the perspective of where we want to move to in the future is we want to make the software kind of self-adaptable, right? Where business users are more empowered to make basically the changes to the software without requiring to bring in consultants and expensive developers to basically write new code or adapt the code to meet their needs. So ultimately the goal with, you know, what we're trying to do in Dynamics AX related to workflow is to basically surface an experience for business users to adapt the software to meet the needs of their business. And only in, you know, on edge cases to bring in developers to introduce some new code or whatever, then assemble that into those business processes to help them adapt the software to their needs.
So that's very challenging. It's kind of scary for us programmer types, right? You're gonna let the business user go in and tweak this process. Now, I guess you used workflow in your, is it the current release?
Yeah, Dynamics AX 2009.
Okay, so, and that uses workflow 3.5?
Correct.
Okay, so is it working? Are business people actually tweaking stuff in that?
Yeah, they are. I think this was our first release of workflow mm-hmm. within the product, kind of the scenarios that we enabled in Dynamics AX 2009 were somewhat limited and more focused around like approval scenarios.
Okay.
So they're less, you know, sort of end-to-end business process scenarios that we enabled in Dynamics AX 2009.
Right.
So we're really empowering business users in the current product to basically change how they handle their kind of their approval scenarios, which are much more, you know, are confined scenarios that aren't as complex as when you think about these really kind of complex end-to-end business processes where you go from creating a requisition to actually paying a vendor. If you automate all that within workflow, is much different than what we enabled in Dynamics AX 2009. But obviously, business users are adapting those approval processes to meet the needs of their businesses, right? To assign it to the correct people, to do, you know, to do a hierarchical assignment, to route the requisitions or the, you know, the documents to the right people.
Okay, so in the history of the product before that release, did you have some other way that people could kind of customize things?
There really wasn't a good way for the business users to uh-huh. customize the product. Within our product in previous releases, obviously we had these, you know, these parameter setup forms where people could go say, oh, I want my, you know, I want my three-way matching within accounts payable to work this way by clicking some checkboxes, right? That would basically change how the software would actually perform the three-way matching, for instance.
Oh, okay.
But that's just like going to a form, clicking a checkbox and saying, this is how I want it to work. It's not actually visualizing the process, for one. Oftentimes, which is a challenge for many business users to understand. So what is the process that's actually running, you know, within the software?
Right.
What is it actually doing? Which is a very large challenge in the product previous to Dynamics AX 2009 to understand what it's even doing,
yeah.
right? And let alone changing it or adapting it to meet the needs of their business. So there really wasn't much there really from a customizability perspective for business users in previous products.
But was this a big ask from your customers?
Most definitely. It's a huge ask from customers that they want to get more visibility into what the processes are, for one, mm-hmm. and secondly, be able to adapt them to their needs.
Ah, okay. So, all right, let's just admit it. Okay, workflow 4 was a big reset, right? Yeah. It was like in .NET 4, we came out and said, guess what, guys? Yeah, you know, you did workflow 3.5. Guess what? We just blew it all away. We blew up the whole thing. Yeah. We started a whole new workflow. So did you guys have this meeting where you went like, are we going to do that? Or are we going to stick with workflow 3.5? What was that like?
So one of the biggest factors in our decision to move to WF4.0 really was around the experience that we had for modeling workflows in Dynamics AX 2009 was really our homegrown kind of designer experience. It wasn't, we didn't rehost the WF designer from .NET 3.5, primarily because it was a challenge to rehost the designer in .NET 3.5. And secondly, not only was it a challenge to rehost it, it was also a challenge to get the experience that we wanted, because we wanted a flowchart sort of modeling style, because that's what business users, when they think of workflow or think of business process, that's what they think. They think of a flowchart. They don't think of the old sequential kind of modeling style that was in the .NET 3.5 designer, right?
And they especially don't think about state machines.
And they don't think about state machines, obviously.
Right.
They definitely don't do that. So that was one of the factors that played, right? Because once we saw the new designer coming out in WF4.0 with the flowchart modeling style, we said, hey, that's what we want, right? That's the kind of experience that we want. And we don't want to go, let's say, to Visio necessarily, because, you know, people can model in Visio and we could hook into Visio. But we wanted to really to kind of fall in line with where we're going at Microsoft related to workflow and how people kind of visualize workflows and model workflows. And with the flowchart modeling style that was coming out in WF4.0, that was a key factor for us moving to WF4.0. Not the only factor. We also kind of did some analysis on the new framework that was being introduced from a runtime perspective in .NET 4 and realized we were going to gain a ton of efficiencies related to kind of the size of our code base.
Right.
Our code base was a little bit larger on .NET 3.5 just because of the fact there was things that weren't as easy to code as they should have been.
Right,
for instance,
right.
the old dependency properties for how you basically do data flow added a lot of code to our stack that wasn't really that necessary.
When you say a little bit less code, earlier you were telling me it was a pretty significant reduction. Wasn't
it? We're thinking roughly 60% reduction in our code base on the .NET 4 stack. So it's definitely, I think, the framework that's there in WF4.0. Has been optimized in such a way that it's really, they've taken our requirements around how we want to do data flow and other things that makes, the ability to pass arguments between activities and deal with internal variables, all that stuff is so much better that it's amazing how much of the code just got reduced because of that one thing, right?
So, well, the other thing I noticed, just my own gut feel, is that the API just feels better. It feels more like the rest of .NET. It feels like if you're used to working with Link and you see the way it likes to work, you go, wow, this workflow kind of feels very much the same. This composability and everything is just wonderful.
Yeah, I think the composability model is very powerful. The usage of Link within the model as well is also very powerful and allows us to do lots of things in less code, right? Ultimately, you want to reduce your code base down to something as small as possible and so that you can manage it moving forward. And these are artifacts that are going to carry forward into other releases and we don't want to rewrite again. So we're hoping that, obviously this stack stays in place for quite a while and we move it forward and it'll live on for a long time.
Okay. So far we've kind of just talked through, generically that your customers have business users who want to be empowered to alter the processes that kind of come out of the box in your product, and they want to say, well, we do approvals this way, or we have these kind of requirements on our thing. So so that led you to this new place using WF4. You got kind of a runtime side of things, and let's talk a little bit about the runtime side, and then we'll talk about the design time side.
Okay.
So one of the things, of course, that people often look for is any process that involves humans is by definition long running because you just have no idea how long it's going to take people to do things.
Yes.
So you guys taking advantage of that in workflow?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, these workflows that we are talking about here, like approval processes, humans are, you know, may be heavily involved. Obviously, for any workflows and any processes that you introduce into the software, you want to automate as much as possible. So we often say that workflows, or at least the human aspects of workflows, are most often kind of the exception cases where you want to involve the humans, not the, you know, not the primary case, because your whole idea is to automate as much as possible, because then your business is as efficient as possible, right?
Sure.
But obviously you can't get rid of the fact that humans are involved. So
we can't eliminate them entirely.
You can't eliminate them entirely.
That's a good thing, I guess. Okay.
Yes, so that's a good thing. So when humans do get involved, obviously the workflow has to persist its state, you know, as you'd expect, and then we have to have some mechanism to, you know, wait on that human action to occur, and then we built into our infrastructure the ability to basically set up some sort of timing to say how long are you giving that person to complete his or her work. And then if they don't complete it by that specific time, then we have sort of policies as to what happens there.
Right.
So if the due date has expired for this approval, then you can actually configure the workflow to escalate to somebody else. You can configure the workflow to auto-approve or auto-reject the request. So we have a whole bunch of, you know, functionality that we integrated into the framework to support those kind of long-running scenarios so that workflows don't get into this state of, you know, never ending and nobody knows what's going on, because that is from our customer's perspective, that is a concern for them, right? There's all this stuff going on in the background now, right, that they don't get visibility into, and they're concerned what happens if things aren't finishing or completing on time. They don't want things just sitting out there forever, right? And they don't want to have to go analyze the history themselves on a daily basis to figure out where things are at. They want the system to basically be able to auto, you know, kind of, you know, auto correct itself or do things on behalf of people when time, you know, when certain due dates expire or things like that.
Now, one of the things that people often say was like, well, you know, I could just write code and do all this. Well, yeah, you could. But one of the things that workflow does is it has this tracking. So it's very heavily instrumented. Every time it's doing something, it's emitting tracking events. Do you guys take advantage of that?
We don't actually hook into the tracking model for from WS perspective. One of the primary reasons for that, which is somewhat unique to our product, is we're dealing with a legacy application here as well, which basically we have our own application server. The code within our application itself is written in our own custom language called X++.
Yeah.
So we have this native runtime, this native application server. So one of the challenges that we had with integrating Windows Workflow Foundation was the fact that, okay, we have this really rich managed runtime that we need to basically kind of bind up to our old native kind of application server, and how do those two things marry up?
Ah.
So in AX2009, actually, our one of the challenges we had was our application server was totally native.
Okay.
There was really no good way to host managed code within our actual application server.
Mm.
So we chose at that point in time to host WF in IIS and then basically use web services to communicate out, initiate workflows, and they would run an IIS, and then we'd have a communication channel back that would do things back in the application.
Yeah.
So in AX6, we're now able to host managed code within our application server, but we still have some challenges still binding up the legacy runtime to WF from the perspective of like carrying transactions from managed code into our application server.
Right.
So one of the reasons we didn't use the tracking infrastructure was we want to ensure that when we save a workflow instance, that not only are we saving the instance state, we're saving the tracking data, we're posting any messages that the application cares about all within a single physical transaction. We never want the tracking data to be out of sync with the state of the instance.
Okay.
Right? So from that perspective, we ended up basically writing our own tracking infrastructure to hook into the basically the persistence provider in workflow to also store tracking at that same point in time. That way we ensure that tracking data, you know, the state of the instance and any application state that we update all occurs in a single physical transaction. We never get out of sync, because that is a huge challenge if you get out of sync.
But that is one of the cool things, actually, about the extensibility they built into the persistence layer. And not everybody knows about this, but a persistence provider gives you an opportunity to do something at in the same transaction as the persistence.
Yes.
Right. So,
yeah. So, I mean, the whole idea is that oftentimes, in our case, for instance, we have these legacy applications. You have an application that requires you to store the state of the instance, the workflow instance, to your own database, to somewhere that you know about that you can actually manage. where using the out-of-the-box persistence provider may not be ideal for you, right?
Right.
Because there is an out-of-the-box persistence provider that'll just store it to SQL and to your into the WF sort of data tables. But that doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't work for us either.
Okay.
Because in our product, you never store directly to SQL Server. You always go through the app server to store data.
Okay.
So in that specific case, we're kind of an, a prime candidate for actually creating a custom persistence provider to basically store the instance state through our channels, right, instead of going directly to the database.
Okay. So one of the things we talk about with WF4 is performance improvements.
Yep.
It's, at least on our test, is significantly faster in a lot of things that it does. Have you guys seen any gain there?
So we have not done our full sort of, we're at the point in our product cycle where we haven't done kind of full end-to-end sort of performance analysis yet, but we're already noticing at just from the aspect of saving instance state that the actual footprint of what we're saving is much smaller and much more granular than it was in the past. In AX or in WF3.5, pretty much the whole workflow instance itself was serialized every time you had to save the state. Now it's much more optimized to save the state where my instruction pointer is right now and only the necessary information to get me back and be able to resume from that point. And then we save that away. So we are noticing that the size of what we're saving is much smaller, which obviously has benefits from the SQL database perspective, because we're talking about tens of thousands of workflows running in the system.
Yeah.
You're going to be filling up the SQL database and things like that. So we already know that there's going to be performance gains. We just haven't analyzed what the difference is between our previous product and the current product.
Now, did you use any of the new messaging capabilities, like the content-based correlation and that sort of thing?
No, we didn't use any of that. We have our own sort of model of, we basically create bookmarks every time we pause the workflow. We keep track of the bookmark and our own messages that we store into our application database. Then every time we call back to the workflow runtime to say resume, we hand that bookmark back.
We
resume based on bookmarks.
So you kind of have a custom host.
Yeah, we have a custom host.
Okay.
Like I said, once again, we're dealing with his legacy applications. We have our own custom host.
Right.
And we're dealing with a lot of this sort of the exchange of messages and correlation stuff on our own. But we're using bookmarks to do it, so we're not like, it's not like we have to jump through hoops to do it, right? It's just hand the bookmark into the runtime and say, hey, go resume from this point, and then it kicks off and goes.
Okay, so you've got here a flowchart, and it looks pretty cool, actually. Tell me a little bit about what we're looking at here.
So what we're looking at, this is our workflow design experience that we surface to business users. So what you're seeing here is actually not a developer experience whatsoever. Developers never see this experience.
Okay.
So just to kind of set some context of what we're seeing here is, so the toolbox over there, you're going to notice that there's these very limited set of activities that can be modeled within this workflow.
Right.
Basically, this represents our own domain-specific language, our own DSL that we're surfacing to business users.
Right.
So obviously, business users aren't going to see send-receives. They're not going to see these low-level constructs that you would see maybe in the developer experience for modeling workflows. So on the left-hand side there, we have approvals, automated tasks, gateways, and tasks. So if you look at these, this is our domain-specific language. These are the building blocks that developers define that ultimately the business user who comes into this experience will then assemble into a structured workflow. So for instance, that purchase requisition approval there at the top, a developer within our product, before we shipped or some, partner had basically goes into our metadata repository and says, I want to create a new workflow approval, defines all the necessary metadata around that workflow approval for all the UI interaction, for any code that's necessary to run when things get approved, defines that there. That then, he associates that to this specific type of workflow, which is a purchase requisition approval, and then it automatically shows up in the toolbox as something that the business user can model within this workflow. And the same goes for all these other things. An automated task obviously is more of a, it's like calling a web service. It's just, I want to invoke some sort of automated thing in the system. It doesn't involve humans. It just runs some code.
Right.
And then that's what you're seeing on the left-hand side. Developers define those things. They surface in the toolbox. And then the business user obviously comes in here and says, okay, I want to create a brand new purchase requisition approval workflow. In this specific case, I already have it created. They come into this experience. They start from a blank slate, right? Uh-huh. They have the start and the end there, and they start dragging the elements in, linking them up through the flowchart modeling style. And then we have custom activities here, as you see, that are on the surface that have our own sort of configuration experience once you, drag and drop them on the canvas.
Okay.
So, for instance, if I come here and select this this activity that I've dropped on for approving the requisition, you'll see we have our own property experience for this. So this specific activity, for instance, has the ability to set up automatic actions where, let's say, I want to auto-approve, right, the requisition if it's under a certain amount. So basically, this says right here, if the purchase requisition dot approval amount is less than $1,000, let me scroll this up a little further. Okay, I'm not seeing everything here. So there's an action down here below that says auto approve. We're just not seeing it in the UI here. But so this is kind of these are our higher level abstractions that we surface to business users that have whole bunches of configuration information on them to allow them to tweak this activity to do what they want it to do. This is even a more complex activity than just that. So if I can drill in, this is a composite activity. So if I drill into this guy, here's my set of approval steps related to completing that approval. So right now I just have purchasing manager approval. Okay. If I wanted to, I could also drag in another step into this and say, I want my manager to approve it, and then it goes to the purchasing manager.
Approval. Right, right.
Right. Okay. So then each of these has configuration information on who to assign it to, what's the time span or the due date time period in order to complete it. They can define conditions around this stuff, guard conditions, and so forth. So as you can see here, these are fairly complex activities that are trying to prevent the business user from having to understand all the guts of what's going on internally.
Right.
Because some people sometimes ask, well, why not just allow them to model the whole approval, in the actual, on the canvas as well, right? Do all the linking up and say, if escalate, then draw arrows. But that's more complex than they want to do. They just want to set some configuration information up for this approval and then have it do what it's supposed to do, right, based on that configuration information.
Now, I have to ask, these are little eight balls, these icons.
Yes. It shows where we're at in our release cycle. We have not received our icons yet.
Oh, okay.
So we are not quite there yet. So, yeah, some icons are there, some icons are not.
All right.
So, and as you saw as well, when I showed you the condition that was associated to this approval, we have basically our own condition editing experience. Since in WF4.0, there's, obviously they have these new expressions that are based on VB expressions, and you can surface those through the workflow modeling experience. For us, VB expressions aren't quite what we want to surface to business users.
Right.
We need some sort of expression experience that is more tailored towards a business user. So this is our, basically, our experience that we surface. So we have the ability to basically look at the context of what the workflow is acting on, reflect across all of its fields, and say, here's all my requisition fields. I can, build something out. And then we have all the relationships as well. So I can go down to the requisition lines and build conditions on that. So basically, this reflects on our entity model that's underneath the covers here and understands what are all the contexts, what's the context of the fields that we can actually build expressions over.
Right, right. Now, that looks pretty simple, though. I mean, it gives you a nice guided experience, and then you can validate that they did something that makes sense.
Yep. And this is another kind of a key thing is the fact that oftentimes when business users are dealing with Boolean expressions, it's hard for them, once they get more than two or three things within that expression, to understand, okay, is this going to do what I expect it to do?
Right.
Is this expression going to evaluate as I expect it to do? Uh-huh. So we also have a functionality in the product that allows them to go pick an existing purchase requisition in the system, right, that they know what's there, and then click test and say, oh, okay, result evaluated to true. So they can, basically gives them a sort of a sandbox environment for validating expressions or conditions to know that they're going to do what they expect them to do at runtime. Because that's also a huge concern with business users is, okay, I modeled this thing.
Yeah.
Is this going to function the way I expect based on what I see in the workflow designer, or is it not, right? It's kind of a challenge for business users at times to feel confident in what their modeling is actually going to run as they'd expect.
So then, at some lower level, right, eventually this expression gets evaluated by something you guys have created, but the workflow engine thinks in terms of VB expressions.
Yes.
So it just calls your thing?
Yeah, so we have basically a link expression that's hooked in that in turn invokes our engine, right, and returns a true-false result back, right?
Okay.
So then we're still, hooked into the workflow framework. It still thinks it's evaluating an expression. Ultimately, we're going back to our specific framework to evaluate it and returning a Boolean result back. And then it takes the corresponding branch accordingly.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, what else you got?
Okay. So some other things that we've done, I guess, to customize the design experience that we believe are kind of just help the business user kind of, you know, get started in modeling and adapting their processes is we have this thing called Auto Connect, that if we turn on this one magic 8-ball down there on the right, that, you know, once I do that, I can then auto connect things. So depending on where I drop, it'll connect up basically without, so drawing the arrows
is even, a pain.
It's a pain at times, right? I just want to drop this thing here and have it, you know, connect up and then be good to go, right? So I can, and then currently in the build we have, there's some arrow drawing issues or some line routing issues. But
yeah.
So I've dropped that thing in there. Now it's auto-connected it between those two, and it's good to go.
Ah, sweet.
So that's one cool thing. Another thing that we've done that I think is somewhat unique. So if, let's say I drag an activity that requires me to configure configure something. So let's drag an approval in that requires me to configure. It's not going to run without me configuring some information on it.
Uh-huh.
So what we have here is if I drill into this this specific approval, we'll see that I have validation errors, that say you must select a role, you must configure the message text, and things like that, right? So this is all basically integrated in to our property editing experience.
Uh-huh.
So when I select that, we have a little bar up here that says here's all the validation errors. So we're using the validation framework within the designer,
right,
but we're surfacing errors also in a more intuitive fashion, more close to where the actual validation is, you know, error is occurring, because we have a lot of complex configuration on some of these activities. We want to get people directed to the location of where the actual validation error is versus just showing a little glyph on the activity and saying, oh, you know, something's not right.
Right.
So
right.
That's why we give this experience and allowing them to, so when I select something, it'll drill me into the actual location to where the validation error is. And it's, for some reason, not doing that at the moment. Oh, there we go. So then it drills me into that specific area within the property editing experience and says, hey, you need to configure this. So that's another, but we're hooked into the validation services within the designer.
Right.
We're just doing some unique things on top of what you'd expect to see, let's say, in a Visual Studio experience.
Well, you know, what's good about this is that, you know, we always imagined that the designer that we built for the product was, you know, it's meant for developers in Visual Studio. Of course, you can put it into just a WPF app, but you still had essentially had the same designer. So they wanted to have the kind of extensibility like you've taken advantage of to get to this point, which is something we didn't intend to build, but we enabled you to build it, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the property editing experience that, as I say, comes in Visual Studio, obviously is, you know, the little, you know, property grid.
Yeah.
Is not ideal for all users, right?
Right,
it
right.
is ideal for more power users and maybe end developers, right? But for our business users, this, you know, we wanted to expose an experience that is more tailored towards them and more something they're used to, right? Because within the product, they never see property grids, right?
Yeah.
They see, you know, things like this, right? So this is what they're used to.
So now, this toolbox, is this the toolbox that we provided, or is that your own custom one?
It is our own custom one, but once again, the extensibility of the designer allowed us to create our own toolbox, and then we basically, you know, when we drag and drop, we hand in that specific activity type into the designer, and then it does the right thing from then on, right?
Sweet, so. Sweet. Well, okay, so that's really super useful that we can see, see this thing come to life in scenarios that we envision that people would be able to use it in.
Yeah.
Now, so where do you stand with this product today?
So related to release?
Yeah, are you in like beta? Or?
So we're kind of in, we have CTP drops that we've been dropping on our, so we're at like CTP2. We'll have CTP3 going out within the next month or 2 months, I think.
Yeah.
And then we'll go beta sometime after that. So we're roughly a little over a year out from shipping.
Okay.
So what you're seeing here is you know, kind of mid-milestone functionality as well, which is the reason you see 8-balls and things like that within the product. But this is close. I mean, this is close to what the end experience is going to be.
So are you getting any feedback from the CTPs? Are people looking at this, liking it?
Or? Yeah, I think people, we've had you know, meetings with the CTP participants and things like that, and I think people are liking this. I mean, this is what they expect to see when they think of workflow. They want to see this because, like I said, in our previous product, we ended up shipping this workflow designer that didn't even look like it was really configuring a workflow. It was like a form with a tree control that I added nodes to tree controls, and people just never got it,
right?
Initially. And they're saying, okay, I'm modeling workflow here. This doesn't feel like I'm modeling workflow. So people get this.
Yeah.
And the added functionality that, you know, we've extended our DSL to add more sort of features and functionality as well. So the the library of activities in their toolbox is much larger than it was in our previous product,
right.
And people are getting that. So they have the ability to explicitly model a conditional gateway now,
right.
or a conditional branch, which in the previous product we didn't really have that because we didn't have a flowchart modeling style, so we had this different sort of modeling experience. So people are getting it, and I think they're loving what they're seeing related to what we're delivering in this version of the product.
So. Awesome. Hey, well, Josh, thank you so much for taking some time today to cover this with me.
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, we appreciate you joining us as well, so we'll see you next time on Endpoint TV.